And I have more slides that I'm going to go through, so please feel free to stop me. And there's a whole bunch of work here that I've done with two faculty members at UCI, James Bullock and Arvind Rajaraman. I mean, the last year or so, really, I've not been thinking about DBN at all, but about structure formation. And you'll see how it links to CDBN sort of halfway through the talk. And then most of the work that's done as far as the structure formation is concerned was led by my postdoc, Luis Trigari, and two students, Greg Martinez and Quinn Miner. So since I started thinking about these models where you have charged particles decaying, I've been trying to like put things in a more generic framework, and so I found that these three slides actually helped me, so maybe it's useful to start with them. So I want to outline three generic properties of dark matter that you're all aware of, but sort of put them on a three-dimensional plot. The first one is this damping length, and this has been calculated, for example, for WIMPs by Hoffman and collaborators. 2001, and we found that the damping length in these cases is such that you give rise to the smallest masses in the smallest mass halos in the universe, which is around an Earth mass. What is this? This is essentially just the mean free path before kinetic decoupling. So here's a heuristic picture. If your dark matter particles are these red spots, then they are scattering off of the ambient plasma, so you have electrons and positrons, for example, and neutrinos that they are scattering off of. It's weak interactions, so you wouldn't be surprised if it decoupled around an MeV. Typically for MSSM, these things decouple around 30 MeV or so. And so, and that leads to the smallest mass halos being around an Earth mass. But in different models, this is going to be very different. Yeah.
The MSSM, the main thing that it just gathers on is what, neutrinos or neutrinos and
well, neutrinos and
but the magnitude of the cross section depends on the model behind it. So
yeah. So there's a that's a good point. There's a whole range. It's not just technical. I mean, so there's probably a range of about less than an order of magnitude, but close to that. Somewhere between like 15, 20 MeV to 100 MeV. So
yeah,
it depends.
Yeah,
it affects the smallest mass. Exactly, yeah. So the second property, which is not that relevant for WIMPs, but it is relevant for other things we'll talk about, is sort of the free streaming length. Now, this, the damping length, I sort of defined as the mean free path before decoupling. This, in some sense, is not the mean free path, but it's the average distance traveled by a dark matter halo, by a dark matter particle before it falls into a potential. So it's sort of a hand wavy way of saying things, but it's essentially the free streaming length before a structure forms. And so now you're just thinking about this particle moving with expansion of the universe and just figuring out, like, you know, on what scales does it wipe out perturbations? That's your free streaming length. The third thing that we don't typically talk much about is, and this is something I've been thinking about, is the average phase space density. So the mass density per unit volume in velocity space, it goes as the mass density divided by sort of the root mean square velocity cube. And the neat thing here is that while the mass density is set by the annihilations, right, so, you know, annihilations in the early universe, the root mean square is in at least for the WIMPs is going to be set by scatterings in the early universe. Okay, for models where you have decaying, you know, particles, that's going to be set by the decay time and the mass difference between the particles. So there's a lot of model parameters that's stuck in there. So here's sort of what happens when you do this. This is an example. So on the x-axis, I have scale, so it's just some length scale. And I'm looking at perturbations of dark matter on those length scales. This has been scaled to the horizon at decoupling. So just imagine you have WIMPs, and they decouple around, let's say, 30 MeV. So this is just some scale divided out by the horizon at decoupling. And the two effects that we talked about, you see clearly, that's the envelope there is the effect of the, I've tuned it so that it's the effect of the free streaming scale. And if I had a damping length of order that's similar, then you get these oscillations. And these oscillations are coming about because in the early universe, the dark matter particles are coupled to the ambient plasma. Okay. So the same reason why we have oscillations in this EMB. Sorry?
Small oscillation. What determines that?
What determines the
depth?
That's basically going to go, it's going to zero. So I've just plotted the square of the thing. So they are really oscillations. Sorry, yeah. So
the stuck with oscillations. I mean, it's getting these different, like you said, ions and photons.
So exactly. So imagine now you have dark matter particles that are actually coupled to the photons. For exactly the same reason why you have oscillations in the photons and the baryons, for the same reason you have oscillations in the dark matter. Because now you're talking about 30 MeV, where it's actually tightly coupled to the electrons and the neutrinos.
So you have the dark matter candidate that couples to photons.
In this case, it's weakly coupled to electrons and neutrinos. But that's the same as photons in the early universe, right? They're all massless particles.
Like neutral ligand.
Let's say a neutral ligand, right?
It's weak interactions.
Yeah, it's weak interactions. But it's tightly coupled, so the phenomenology is exactly the same. It's the same reason. Okay. So those are the three properties, and then in the next three slides, what I want to do is just give you an idea of what those things actually do to structure formation in the late universe. So free streaming and damping, so these were the two lengths I defined. Unfortunately, I haven't really found any way where you can distinguish one from the other. At the end of the day, everything just looks like the power spectrum is suppressed. So what really just happens is that perturbations get erased below some length scale, okay? So here's a plot of some number of halos per unit mass that you would get in the late universe as a function of the mass. And essentially, what you expect is something like that. Now, these simulations are really hard to do. There's only a couple of really good ones. There's one that people have done for WIMPs. This was done by Ben Moore and Demand and collaborators. And they really did see this power, the number of halos actually cutting off, okay, on those scales, as you would expect. And the neat thing was they actually saw some of these small mass halos survive in their simulations, which naively, they may not have just because they're small and they might have gotten ripped apart. We still don't know whether these things will survive all the way down to the present time. So the second thing is this phase space density. And what that does is actually very, very different from what the power spectrum does, okay? And the phase space density, one way to think about this is just that if I take a halo and look at how the density changes as a function of radius, then the phase space density is telling me that I can't keep stuffing particles into the center, okay? In other words, this can't keep rising up. It has to flatten off at some point. Now, exactly where it flattens off depends upon what the primordial phase space density is. And I'll show you numbers for different models, but for example, for a WIMP, it's really, really large, and there's really never any time you have to worry about it as far as structure formation is concerned. There's a good reason for that. This was actually first said in the language that I've just said by Gunn and Tremaine in 1979, and they were looking at neutrinos. So what they basically said is that the neutrinos have some phase space density early in the universe before they've collapsed into a halo. Once they collapse into the halo, the maximum phase space density in the halo can never be larger than that. Okay, and therefore you put a limit on how large the density is. And in fact, you can figure out what the size of this core is in galaxies. Now that can't be really directly applied to the kind of things people have been discussing here, which is decaying particles. So I'll show you later on how we have to change that. But essentially, the physics is just the same. It's just that you can't keep stuffing particles into the center. Okay.
There are some cooling mechanisms for waves.
Yeah. So if you have interactions with waves, then it's different. So as I said, so this is all based on just collisionless. But for the waves, at least, it's a very reasonable approximation. So what this does is, you know, so one of the things it does is, if you look at a halo, then you might see this core. Turns out this is going to be very, very hard. There's a very generic predictions of these kinds of, you know, for the core size as a function of mass. The core, the physical core size, is actually smaller at larger masses. So if you want to look for these effects, you got to go to really, really small masses. Okay. So you have to look at very small galaxies. There's no point trying to look at things like the Milky Way. There'll be a core maybe, but it'll be so close to the center that you're never going to be able to get information about it, especially because baryons change everything once they cool. Okay, so we'll come back to that in a bit. The other thing it actually does is, because now you have this core, the halo in some sense is less concentrated. And so imagine you have a big halo like our own, like Milky Way, and a smaller one comes in. If it's less concentrated, then it's easier to disrupt that core. It's easier to disrupt that galaxy that's coming in. And so you generically predict less substructure. Okay, so number of subhalos. So these are smaller halos inside a bigger halos. And so you actually predict something like this. Now, this has never been actually seen in a simulation. And we are now running some simulations where we have results. And the point is to actually quantify this. And I'll tell you why this is important, because, you know, apart from the Lyman alpha forest, I think this could be the best way of actually putting limits on, for example, these decaying models. Okay, so hopefully I've given you an idea of, you know, what the free streaming and Q do in the late universe, and we'll come back to data at the end. One interesting question you can ask is, what's the relation between Q and this free streaming scale? For example, if you just have a sterile neutrino dark matter, then essentially, they're both, you know, if you tell me what Q is, I'll tell you what free streaming scale is. If you tell me what the free streaming scale is, I'll tell you Q, because all it depends upon is the mass of the warm dark matter particle. Here, if you think about decaying, you know, dark matter that comes about because of the decay of some particle, you have two things, right? You have, for example, you have the mass difference between the particles and lifetime, or the two masses of the particles, however you want to think about it. There are two variables to play with. And so you might think that these two things are separate. But for, it just turns out, and I'll show you in the next slide why, that in fact, it looks pretty much like it's a one parameter family of models. Okay? And that's for the following reason. So if I just think about a particle that's decaying in the early universe when it's radiation dominated, then the left-hand side, which I've written as CS times eta, is just some sound horizon times sound speed times the horizon. So that's essentially your free streaming scale, if you want to think about it. That one, the left-hand side, that goes as just 1/(Q^1/3). So everything is just determined by Q. So even in these cases where we have, for example, a star decaying to a gravitino, it's just a one-parameter family of models. I can map it back to some sterile neutrino, dark matter. Okay, so if you tell me what Q is, then I can tell you what the free streaming scale is. The only way in which I found of actually changing that relation is if I make the decay happen very, very late. So if you make the decay happen in the matter dominated regime, okay, and the difference comes about just because of the way the expansion rate scales with time. Okay, it's a few steps, but then you find that it actually depends separately on Q and on the lifetime. Okay. Now these are kind of contrived, like you know, the, in order to get this, what you need to do is take a 500 GeV particle, let's say 500 GeV neutrino. It can't be charged particle. You would get in really bad, you'd be in really bad shape with structure formation. But let's say a neutrino, which is 500 GeV, and the mass difference between the neutrino and the gravitino would have to be 10 GeV or so. Okay, so there has to be maybe some other symmetry reasons, or it's just an accident, but you have to have two states that almost have the same mass in order for this to work. Okay?
We're going to be detectable now.
But such a decay will also produce the gamma, and diffuse gamma in background.
Yeah, it at least for the things we've looked at, you satisfy the diffuse gamma rays and the neutrino flux. But for the simple, the neutrino decaying to a gravitino, at tree level there's no gamma rays.
Right, but
you get gamma rays.
Forward decay.
Yeah, so when you put in the thing, I mean, they're all suppressed by an alpha.
Compared to CDM density. Yeah, maybe 10 to minus 10 times more.
Yeah, so remember that the gamma rays are coming out at like huge EV, and this is at a redshift of 1,000. So by the time you get today, these are all in the X-ray regime.
Yeah,
they're
60, but still there is upper bound.
There's an upper bound, but for these models, I'm just telling you that we've checked.
Okay, so
and it doesn't violate, yeah, it doesn't violate it. But you're right, in general, that you know, there is going to be an amount coming from these things. But for the ones that we looked at, it was okay. So the point here was just, you know, we wanted to just see if we can break this, you know, one parameter family of models and actually get something that depends on two things. You can, but you have to work hard, you know, and I don't know any good reason why you would expect, you know, two states to lie so close to each other in mass. But kind of it's interesting phenomenology. Okay, so what this does for you, for example, is that you can get a small Q. Remember, Q tells me sort of what's the size of the cores in galaxies today. But at the same time, I can make that small, so that the free streaming scale is small by increasing the lifetime. Okay, so here's an example of a power spectrum. Forget the units, and this is plotted in inverse. Scale length, which is K. The solid line is CDM, just a standard WIM. And this would be, you know, like the kind of things you've been talking about here, which is a star, let's say, decaying to a gravitino, or in this case, it's neutral. And the cutoff scale goes as Q to the minus 1/3. And what you get by making the decays happen late is this dotted line. So this would be consistent with pretty much all Lyman alpha bounds. But at the same time, you can get very small values of Q. Okay. So let me just wrap up this dark matter model space thing by putting everything on one plot. Now, as I said, I don't really know how to distinguish between collisional damping length and free streaming. In most cases, what just ends up happening is they both combine and give you just some one effective length scale. But it's still interesting to put different models in this parameter space. And a super WIMP is just basically can have very, very low phase space densities, but it doesn't have to be warm, right? It depends upon what the lifetimes is and things like that. It could be you know, pretty cold, and that you'll never find the difference between that and a normal WIMP, at least in structure formation. Okay. So I want to say a few lines about observations. So just look, I mean, the warm and cold divide is kind of artificial, it's just a sliding scale. But the two powerful constraints that we have now are, one is from the Lyman alpha forest. Okay, and this is results from, initially from Seljak et al. And it's a phenomenally strong constraint on these models. Okay. What it says basically is that the power spectrum cannot fall to half of the CDM value on scales larger than about 10 kpc. And this was almost, you know, a factor of few, maybe 5 times better than the previous results. Okay, so it's a very strong constraint. In the last year or so, I think there's been more reasons to sort of doubt this, you know, the strength of these constraints. And one, because I don't think people really understand the IgM as well as they thought they did. So for example, when people do these simulations, you parameterize what you think is the temperature of the IgM as a function of its density. And typically, it's just some power law. And people looking at the distribution of fluxes have found that this is not a good way to do things. At least as low densities, it's not very clear that they understand what the temperature density relationship is. And all of this feeds in and changes the limits you get from Lyman alpha 4s. So I think you have to be careful about just taking this number or just taking the Soljak et al. Results and just ruling out models. This is going to change. So the other way I think is very promising is looking at the local groups. So looking at essentially the Milky Way and its satellite galaxies. And even now, you can already say that the smallest mass halos have to be less than around 10 to the 9 solar masses. Now, the way you link these two things is, if I take that number blindly, then the smallest mass halos is going to be around 10 to the 6, 10 to the 7. Okay, so you see how powerful those constraints are. I mean, if this is really true, then it's going to be very, very hard to distinguish any sort of supervimp or a stellar neutrino model from CDM, because it's going to be hard to try and look for small halos as small as 10 to the 6. Maybe gravitational lensing, but at least not right now. Okay. But as I said, I'm not really sure about what the numbers here should be. Okay. But at least this you can be pretty sure about, just because you've seen halos. Now we know about 20 satellites in the Milky Way. And 10 to the 9 is a reasonable number to keep in mind.
So strong into like a mass scale for the kingdom, for example, or stellar neutrino, which come up with this 10 kb or the first.
This is like around stellar neutrino is around 12 kb or something like that, 14 kb. This would be more like 4 or something like that. So it's, you know, they're all, in terms of masses, they're all pretty close. But when you look at stuff, you know, if you make one order of magnitude difference in the free streaming scale, there's 3 orders of magnitude in a mass. And it becomes much more difficult to like sort of get a handle on that. But you know, I really don't know what number I should put in. Okay.
There's also this realization thing which string radar, which claimed that it's very difficult to realize early if you have warm dark matter.
We should probably talk about that. I mean, I think realization is an even bigger issue that, you know, problem than in terms of putting constraints on it. I mean, you looked at that, I don't think that can give you as robust constraints as a local group. But maybe we can talk about this at the end. The last part about these observations is, you've all heard about these problems for CDM on small scales, and you know, a few years ago, I used to buy into this. I don't really think there is any way you can stand up and say that CDM is in dire straits. From small-scale structure observations. So I just want to put up, I want to put up two slides. One, which is, different lines here, but you've all heard about this cusp and the core issue. Is there, you know, there are galaxies that we've looked at, which seems to suggest that the density profile doesn't keep rising steeply, okay? That there is this sort of a core in the density. And typically the way they do this is to look at the rotation speed as a function of radius. So sorry, this is cut off. This is radius, and it's going out from like one few KPC out here. And the point is that, you know, if you look at the best data, and initially people used to have one-dimensional data, so you put slits on a galaxy. But now you have 2D velocity curves, so you're actually mapping, for example, this velocity as a function of r and theta, which is a whole lot better. You can get a handle on the systematics. So these are some of the best data out there. You know, there's a few more galaxies like this, but it's a handful. I can count them on my, maybe 10 or so. And the thing is that some of them seem to suggest, forget the lines, but just take it those things seem to be better fit by an NFW profile. Well, these things seem to be better fit by something that has a core. Okay, and you know, the thing that you need, I think, we take away from this is just that, you know, there's a lot of stuff about baryons there affecting your measurements that we don't really understand. And I don't think there's any way in which you can really really say for sure that there is actually a problem. There's more data out there. We have a postdoc at Irvine who's been analyzing some of these things, and it certainly looks like there are a few galaxies which definitely seem to prefer a core. But you know, it's not clear to me that, you know, that's not got to do with, like, you know, more complicated rotations, you know, non-circular rotation of the gas at the center of the galaxy. Okay. So this one I wouldn't put my money on. The other one is this missing satellite problem, right? And this was made famous by Ben Moore and collaborators, and Anatoly Klibin and collaborators in 99. And what this does is plot the number of halos as a function of the mass of the halos, number of subhalos as a function of their mass. Let's say in something that's like the Milky Way. And that's the theoretical prediction from simulations, the red one. And these are the observed Milky Way satellites. Actually, it's gone up by a little bit. I don't have an updated plot. But it still looks very flat as opposed to that which is rising up. And so, you know, this was an issue for CDM. How do you make this happen? And the typical way you go about it is to say that, well, you know, not all subhalos have to light up. Okay, these are the dark subhalos, but why should they all light up and become galaxies? So you got to come up with a good way in which, you know, you can make that transition. And for example, here's just two different ways of doing it. This is just taken from Dima and et al. Simulation. What's been done here is take this red line and then pick, for example, if you concentrate on this blue points here, pick all the subhalos that formed earlier than redshift of 10. Okay, and that's that. And so if you tell me that something happened at redshift of 10, reionization, that prevented gas from falling in and actually lighting up, then, you know, this is a reasonable hypothesis. Okay? And note that there's no error bars on that black, so. But this would be consistent with the observed distribution. Now, as we find more and more satellites, whether that's the case or not, I don't know. These are the subhalos, right? So what's done here is basically we took from Dieman et al. Simulations all the subhalos that formed before redshift of 10. And 10 because, you know, if you assume reionization happens at 10, then there's UV photons, and that heats up the gas. And so if you're not big enough, then you're not able to keep the gas in. And so if some of the gas had already collapsed before 10, then okay, those halos will retain the gas. But if you formed after redshift of 10, then you don't retain the gas. Okay, that's one hypothesis, right? And that seems to fit well with the data. So any way you look at it, you know, whether you think this is reasonable or not, the point is that you have to put in this astrophysics. And so this is at least a good way of ruling out models, but I'm not again sure that this is a way to say that a CDM is wrong. Okay, so since I'm running out of time. So what I wanted to do was do two more things. One is basically just one comment about CBVN that my students have been working on, and the other one is look at the local group for the last 5 minutes or so, okay? Because that's the part where I think observationally we can make the biggest jump. So there's a whole bunch of constraints on these dark matter models, where the dark matter comes from decays of particles, whether it's be neutral or charged. This is just what I remember from memory. There's a whole slew of work here that's been done. One of the things that I was thinking about long ago, but just sort of lost interest, but I came back to this after reading Carsten's paper on the PX states, is molecular bound states, and Maxim also had this in his recent paper. So what Quinn, my student, has done is basically to make this plot, what he basically did is really do to solve for both helium XX and helium X, and you can ask me the details later. But the binding energy of helium X relative to helium XX, helium XX relative to helium X is 290 keV, which, if you remember, is basically the same as the binding energy of helium X. Not far. And so what basically happens is, as soon as helium X forms, helium XX starts forming. Okay. And I've forgotten what the mass of the dark matter here is. I think it's probably 100 GeV. But essentially, you get a few percent, in this case, it's a couple of percent of helium XX. Now, this is a neutral particle, okay, helium XX. And so your first thought is, this is just going to do so much damage. It's going to change things at late times. And the reason for being interested in this is really this whole issue of, should you really be interested in decays that happen late? Late meaning, much larger than 1,000 seconds, because they are the ones that really change structure formation dramatically. Okay, so and here's, this is about 10,000 seconds, right? So this would, if your lifetime's larger than, if your lifetime's larger than 10,000 seconds, then maybe helium XX can really do a lot of damage. What is this? Oh, so this is just a plot of sort of the, if you want to think about this, the bonding and the anti-bonding orbitals. And just the only point here with this calculation, it's exactly analogous to the H2 plus calculation, is that for recombination, you have to include the vibrational modes, right? This R is the distance between the two X's, right? So if you can have large vibrational modes where you fall into this, with a very small, at very large radii. And so you have to be careful about that. And that basically ends up meaning that, your recombination rates are always going to be larger than the dissociation. So as soon as there's enough helium XX around, you're going to start forming helium XX.
Yes.
Can
you repeat that point about the vibration points?
It's just, so the potential energy curve, you have to worry about the vibrational modes, just because when the helium XX are separated widely, you can easily fall into this this state. Mm-hmm. Right? But it's not easy to fall. I mean, if you have to dissociate, then you still need that energy.
You can think of this as, excited states of this molecule. So you can start to, capturing it into the excited state and sort of radiates it down. But there is an important reaction that removes the prime. I mean, helium itself rescatters on helium XX and forms beryllium 8X and spits out an X. Right? Rate for this is large.
Right. So Quinn has included that. So one of the things we were looking at was also what Maxim had said about forming a lot of beryllium 9. Does this actually change things? So I don't know. The short answer is, what he finds is that it doesn't really change anything Maxim said. I mean, there's a lot of beryllium 9 left over at the end of the day, and that's that. What about lithium 6? I'm not 100% sure about this, but Quinn's claim is that really all that happens is that late times you form even more lithium 6. It's not as if you destroy any of this guy.
You missed some discussion.
I know, I missed something that yesterday, but maybe we can ask this again over. I think this is really interesting just because of this late lifetimes really do leave a very big effect on structure formation. So we really need to know whether, whether we should take this part of the curve seriously, whether the large lifetime, And if you want to do that, you know, you have to certainly include the contribution from Helium XX. But, you know, to be honest with you, I haven't put that much thought into this right now. I mean, this is student Quinn, he's been doing all of the work, but I sort of believe him when he says that nothing, you know, he tried to look at formation of other things. You know, first I thought when I was doing this that, well, you're going to form some carbon and maybe like you're going to form a lot of carbon and oxygen and things like that. Doesn't really happen. So it seems like what's happening here is you're forming more lithium six. It'll be really, you know, maybe I've missed something here and maybe you do destroy a lot of these lithium sixes. But if this is right, then I think what Maxim said stays. I mean, you basically, anything larger than 10,000 seconds or so, if it's a charge decay, then it's not viable, okay?
Densities, we are talking about dark matter densities. At those densities, like, it seems out of the question, even like if you would take my paper, you know?
Which
only gives like a rough estimate, a really rough estimate and some variations on it.
Yeah, so even when you did that, I guess.
Quite a lithium six, even the bomb shot he was produced before.
Yeah. So maybe that's the answer. Maybe we just forget about charged case for. But then your solutions of like, you know, what is it, 1,000 seconds or earlier, I mean, those things are still interesting. So that's probably the region to focus in. And then that's another thing that I've been, that I'll be doing over the summer is, one of the things we don't really have is a full calculation of the power spectrum when you have a charged particle decaying with large differences in the masses, okay? It's, all the calculations have been done in the limit where if you have a charge decay, then the mass difference is small. So this was done by Markey, Minkowski, and Chris Sigurdsson. Or you forget about the you know, the charge part and do that. What I showed you, the power spectrum, which is just a neutral particle decaying. It's actually kind of messy to do them both together.
Can I ask you something? Are there any benefits from charge for the?
Except that, you know. So let's say we look at these solutions where you have, you know, where you get the right lithium abundance and, you know, it's maybe around 1,000 seconds or 1 second or whatever, right? You want to know if that solution to lithium six is right, then what do you predict for structure formation, okay? If it's 1 second, nothing today, but with gravitational lensing, maybe you predict something, you know, 5, 7, 10 years down the line. Maybe there's a way in which you can see these. You make a prediction saying that if lithium six is solved by this, then here's what you need, what you will see. And to do that, you have to be, you know, you really have to do this calculation, what I was telling you. And so that's that, you know, hopefully, you know, in a couple of months or maybe 3 months, that should be done. There's nothing, you know, it's straightforward. It's just a messy calculation.
I don't quite understand, because like this is anything beyond the free splitting of particles, because like.
No, it's both free streaming and the charge, and the fact that it's charged, it couples to the plasma. So if you want to know the free streaming, if you want to really know the suppression to within a factor of few, 3 or so, which makes a factor of 30 in mass, then you have to do this thing properly. But if you just blindly want to know what the free streaming scale is, that's easy.
If I remember the papers of Silverson and Kaminkowski, right, like they assumed the lifetime of 10 to the 7 seconds. For the charged particle.
Yeah.
So since there is so much known in 1,000 seconds, I would have assumed that it's the coupling of the charged particle with photons, really, which makes
this
suppression.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But in that case, the scale is very small compared with Sigurdsson, Capitana. So just the mass gap should be smaller, or in that region, we have to solve the nonlinear effect of the fluctuation. Nonlinear, not the linear.
So let me back up and say, if you're thinking about decay in a second, then you know, as I said, I don't think there's any observations you can make today that's going to help you. But around 1,000 seconds, if you're interested in this regime. Then the free streaming scale is going to be much smaller, but you know, maybe the free streaming scale is like, you know, 1 kpc or so, somewhere around there. I forget the numbers. And that's relevant for gravitational lensing, you know, which tries to look for, like...
But to predict the correct evolution of the gravitation, you need the non-linear effect, non-linear, because it's not the linear.
No, that's true, because you need structure information at the end of the day. But I'm saying, even to say, even just from linear theory to say what the minimum mass halo is, that's not yet done. Like, you can't use the Sigurdsson and Kamienkowski picture for that, just because there you make the simplification that the mass difference is so small that essentially it's, you know, the gravitino, for example, if it, in that case it was basically two wings. The daughter particle is non-relativistic all the time, which is not going to be true here, right? So that's probably one calculation that needs to be done, which will sort of relevant for this, maybe 1,000 lifetimes, 1,000 second lifetimes. Okay, so can I take like a couple of more minutes and then I'll push and stuff. Okay, so so I've been really interested in the local group, you know, and I've sort of told you what the other reasons are. There's actually a cute way of figuring out what the phase space effects are, but you know, maybe we can talk about this later. I just want to tell you about some new observations. So here's a picture. Well, this is actually a small movie which speaks 1,000 words. Just bear with me one sec. So just for everyone, I found this thing on a NASA website. The thing we are interested in is, so that's the Andromeda and that's the Milky Way, are these small blobs around the Milky Way, and also interestingly, small blobs around the Andromeda. We've been able to like measure, for example, we recently got data for some dwarfs around the Andromeda. Okay, so one of the things you can actually do is build a census of these dwarfs, how many of them there are, and that number has changed dramatically since Sloan came up. So this looks like a messy diagram, but it's actually a very, very interesting diagram. This is the luminosity, or the magnitude, of essentially dwarfs and globular clusters. These are all globular clusters in our own galaxy. This is the size of the galaxy. It's log of the size of the galaxy in parsecs. So this is 100 parsecs, 1 kiloparsec. Okay, these are all the small new dwarfs that have been found in photometry from Sloan, and then people have gone back and looked at the stars and the galaxy and figured out that indeed it is actually a real galaxy. Okay, there's actually supposed to be lines here of surface this, so constant surface brightness has lines like that. Okay, so and more of these will be found. And on top, they are the old ones that we knew of, the squares and the circles. Okay, so there's a whole bunch of new ones that have been found. And as more and more get found, this puts a limit on, for example, the free streaming scale. Okay, I said it was 10 to the 9 right now, but you know, there's couple of sky surveys that are going to happen, like Sky Mapper and down the line LSST. They'll just actually, you know, basically get most of these guys in the sky. Okay, Sloan's only surveyed about a fifth of the sky. So I think this is one interesting way where you can get down to maybe 10 to the 6th, 10 to the 7th solar mass, smaller stellars. And then on top of that, gravitational lensing may help us get lower down. Another reason why this is interesting is because turns out that these tiny things, their luminosities are very, very, very small. Okay. By the way, one interesting thing is that these are all named, you know, for the constellations they're in, except for this Willman one. That's because when Beth Willman first discovered it, she thought it was a globular cluster. Globular clusters get named after the people who discovered them. But then it turned out it was a real galaxy, but a name sticks. So I think she's the only one to have a name on a galaxy. But that's the confusion between these things, right? What is a globular cluster, which typically has no dark matter, and something like Willman one? This has a luminosity, measured luminosity of 1,000 suns. But it seems to have the same dark matter halo as some of those big ones up there, which have luminosities of 10 million. okay? Same dark matter halo. One way to look at this is if you think the dark matter is made up of WIMPs, here's a plot of just the flux from annihilations for some reasonably optimistic MSSM model. And what I want you to note is that these three, this, the blue line, and the red line, are the three new dwarfs that have been discovered. And the green one is one of the largest old dwarfs. And so in terms of flux of particles annihilation, these guys are, you know, just as bright or even brighter. Okay, the uncertainty is pretty large because there aren't, you know, we haven't measured enough velocities of stars in there. But these are really interesting things. And here, just to, this has gotten cut off. So this is just the flux for you expect from WIMP annihilations. And what was plotted down here, which has gotten cut off, is actually the scattering cross section for direct detection. And so if I'll just tell you this without showing you, but essentially direct detection is starting to creep into this parameter space. This is a constrained MSSM model. So the direct detection guys are creeping in here, somewhere here. And that's sort of the 5-year limit expected from BLAST. And this is from the new dwarf, Willman 1. So they are pretty interesting as far as WIMPs are concerned, but I also told you they're really interesting as far as, you know, our other models are concerned. So I had one plot, and I'll finish. So I'll finish with this plot, but here's a list of 18 of the 23 known satellites of the Milky Way. And what's amazing is that as currently, they have luminosities measured from 1,000 solar masses all the way to 10 million solar masses. And if you look at the mass within 300 parsecs, because that's the mass we can really measure well, they all seem to have the same mass. So they all seem to live in this big halos. And it's an open question whether this is consistent with CDM or not. But I think this is a place where, you know, for the kinds of models we've been talking about, we can actually maybe make some headway here. So sorry for running over. Thanks.
This is very interesting. Could that be a selection effect if they only can see 10 to the 7 solar mass halos?
No, I thought about it. It's a good question. I mean, the selection effect is really just, you know, so how are these guys discovered in the first place? I mean, most of them are discovered in just the photometry of Sloan, right? So you look for, and it's sort of black magic, I think. But some people discover it and some people don't. But you just look for some region of sky, you make some color cuts, and figure out that, hey, there's a bunch of stars there that look like they all belong together. Okay. If you look at one of these, I don't know if you've ever looked at one of these regions, but I've seen, you know, they'll show me a region which is 10 degrees by 10 degrees, and say, hey, there is a galaxy in there. You look at that, there's no way. Because the backgrounds, you know, the Milky Way has so many background stars, and it just all looks like a swath of stars. Okay, but if you make these color cards, and you have, you know, you've done this for a long while, and my Nervous group, the Cambridge, does really well, they can actually pick these out. And the way then you know it is so for a fact is you go back and look at it and figure out the velocities. You have to get spectra and then figure out how fast they're moving, and then you know whether they're all moving together or not, things like that. So the selection effect is really one of surface brightness. And I can't see any obvious way in which that would correlate with the mass of these. Because, you know, it's just number of stars spread out over some area. So I don't think it's a selection effect. So we've been trying to actually figure out if this is something which is consistent with CDM or not. It's kind of early yet, but it might be. But you have to then tell me why it is that for the same mass, it's not the carbon mass that's really that interesting in some sense. It's the fact that they have a luminosity over 4 orders of magnitude. Right? So at one mass, there's a spread in luminosity of 4 orders of magnitude. What does that? You can't tell me that this is all because of, you know, here's a satellite that falls into the Milky Way. And it's all because the stars are getting stripped. Right? your hypothesis might be, well, Grundmann 1 was the same as Fornax, but it lost 10 to the 4 stars as it fell into the Milky Way. Okay, that's maybe possible. But stars in the center tend to be more tightly bound in the dark matter. If you lose stars, it's a collisionless process. You're going to lose your dark matter also, which is gravitational power, right? Tidal effect. So if you lose that many stars, you're going to lose almost all your dark matter too. So it just seems very difficult to imagine that, you know, this spread is coming around because of just stars being lost in the Milky Way. So you might then argue that this is all reionization. Something's happening at Z of 10 that's giving you this really huge spread. But simple Tony models never give you any spread which is this large. So I don't really know what's the reason for this.
I have a naive question.
Yeah.
Do you know if the luminosity is also coming from this within 300 parsecs? Or?
No, but so you can make the same.
It could be just a difference between the total mass of these guys, which is not 10 to the 7.
The total mass is not 10 to the 7. I don't know what the total mass is. It's a quantity that's completely indeterminate.
Yeah.
You can make the same plot, luminosity within 300 parsecs, and things don't change. These guys, a few of these guys here, have extents that are smaller than 300 parsecs. But the older ones have extents which are sort of 300 parsecs or larger. That's why we chose 300 parsecs. So that bias is minimized.
So, not to harp on this anymore, but is this, so the fact that you get the same mass within 300 parsecs, is that telling you something about uniformity of density distributions?
My first thing, thought was, you know, well, if there's no mass, it doesn't look like there's anything less than 10 to the 7, then maybe that's because there's no halos in the universe with masses less than 10 to the 7, meaning it's gotten cut off, okay? Which is sort of what you would predict from these CBVN, the kind of, I mean, these decaying particle models. But you have to keep in mind what was just mentioned, which is, you know, this is mass within 300 parsecs. It's not the total mass. The total mass would be larger. And maybe there's some astrophysical reason why this happened. But on my answer, I don't know.
But if they all have the same density profile, if you integrate it at 300 parsecs, then you always get the same answer.
Yeah, but then the question is why do we all have the same, you know, for the same density, why do they have four orders of magnitude?
Sure. Fair enough. No, that's very interesting.
That's the question, yeah. That really does mean that they have the same density profile.
This is maybe, can you see all the stars? Can you see all these stars in there, or could there be like some confusion, some which are too close at the detection threshold?
No, you can't see all the stars. So that's another thing that people are now going back and looking at this. So you can try to figure out how much gas there is in these guys, and there isn't much. Not all of them have measured gases, but a whole range of them have measured gases. So it's not gas. The other thing you can ask is, well, these are pretty faint objects, and you only see the brightest of them. Okay, so how do you know what the luminosity function is? For some of them, there are very deep observations, and so you know the luminosity is reasonably well. And if you make the same extrapolation, then we shouldn't be all that bad. Okay, but again, there's no way that you miss 10 to the 4, a factor of 10 to the 4. It could be a factor of few, because you're not seeing the low end, the tail of the luminosity function. And the only way to do that is go back and look at these guys with just deeper observations. It does seem crazy that, you know, it just has 1,000 stars. The luminosity is just like 1,000 solar masses. I mean, what's next, like 100? You have a galaxy with 100 stars? I mean, so it is kind of weird. And that's why nobody believed that these were galaxies. But then, the stars have dispersions of 4 to 5 kilometers per second. They're moving so fast that something has to keep it in. You know, it's very similar to the dispersion of those large guys. That's the only way to tell. And something else about metallicity and things like that. But I don't know. That's another thing people are looking at is going back and getting deeper observations to see how far off you are. By the way, these are close. This is 30 kpc, whereas most of the other guys are 100 kpc, which is why it's pretty good for indirect detection also.
Excuse me, could you please tell me when the kinetic decoupling corresponds to produce the 10 to 7 solar mass?
10 to the 7.
Maybe 8.
Oh, in terms of wimps? Oh, there's no way to do it. I mean, yeah, it has to be a decaying particle.
But this is very late.
It's very late, that's true. So,
but you are discussing this.
But 1,000, even 1,000 seconds won't work. It has to be probably a little larger.
Yeah.
So 10 to the 7 solar masses is about 100 kpc.
Yeah, you are expert.
So.
But I worry that one second. What if you consider decay or something? So it may affect the back BVN or background visible gamma ray or background X-ray.
Wait, I'm confused. What are you talking about now? You're talking about something like this, right?
You produce such a mass scale.
Yeah, I don't remember exactly what the number is, but it's probably like 10,000 seconds or maybe larger.
It won't be shorter than that.
Yeah.
But you are interested in such a cutoff of the mass scale, right?
So maybe that's what you're asking, but one thing to keep in mind is it's exactly what you said before. The smallest mass halos that you compute are in linear theory.
Mm-hmm.
Right? What happens when structure actually forms, we don't really know, right? It might be that, you know, so
yeah, but the scale is large.
The scale is large, but
not linear reason is okay.
Yeah.
If you consider the 1,000 seconds or something, right? Intuitively, I understand the non-linear effect is important, and it might be smelled out.
It's not just so. Supposing I want to plot, like, you know, the number of halos, sub-halos, right, in a Milky Way, as a function of the mass, right? If you take linear theory, you'll actually end up predicting something like that. But we've been doing simulation, and you know, then this would be your cutoff mass, okay? Which would be determined from linear theory. But we've done some simulations now. Actually, Anatoly Klipin has done, where you actually start seeing this effect well before. It looks like that. It doesn't match Peschecter. It doesn't match what you would expect from linear theory. In which case, it's a big deal because, you know. A smaller cutoff mass, which means a smaller free streaming scale, can have a pretty large effect. That makes sense, right? So even a smaller free streaming scale could have a larger effect on this. So you know, blindly, if you say something like 10 to the 6 or 10 to the 7, it's not that easy to like say what scale do you need. You can only say it has to be smaller than something. So maybe 1,000 seconds is still interesting, but that's something I've known.
So I'm a bit confused because it usually depends on the difference between masses, daughter, and parent particle as well.
Yeah.
As well as the decay time, the free streaming velocity.
Yeah, it depends on both.
But given the time, like, it would depend on the mass difference as well.
Yeah, so I guess you can make the mass difference really large and go to very small decay time.
That's fine.
Or you can tune things and make that the decay time large and make the masses really, really, really small.
So we find this, like, those models, like, which have a start decaying into Galatina at 1,000 seconds, the warm dark matter effects are quite large. You're almost at the limit of being ruled out by the dynamical force.
Oh, for, I guess,
so like, plus given the decay time, is not enough.
I should have forgotten that, but yeah, that's true. So the mass difference does plays in because that's what gives rise to the velocities anyway.
Yeah.
So for 1,000 seconds, you can still get something that large as this, you're saying?
You get fairly large long dark matter effects.
For reasonable models.
But I can't give you a mask right now, I'm just checking, but you get you are, this corresponds almost like to, I think, to a 3 kV.
So if you make the mass difference large enough, you can get this effect. So
that wouldn't happen because your K is plus the Planck scale, so that's why you don't have to have degeneracy.
Yeah, I think the content is interesting in the larger mass.
I have a suggestion. Let's break for coffee and save this for the later for 3 hour discussion.